Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We are seeking to reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus, seeking to take the headlines of the day and apply the mind of Christ and then become equipped as Christ's ambassadors in the context of the culture in which we live. So what we're going to do today is what we do every day, and that is literally visit the headline news and talk about it from a Christian worldview. And so today's a little different in that I actually have a conversation partner for the entire hour, and we're taking your calls. So Peter Kapsner, who you know from the morning show here on Faith Radio, is joining me. Hello, Peter. Well, maybe Peter's not on yet, but he will be soon. And then also later in the show, we're going to actually be taking your calls. So as you're listening to our conversation or as you're thinking to yourself, you know, there's a conversation going on in the culture or in my home, and I'd really like some insight and some help on how I might bring God back into that conversation. We are going to take your calls here in the studio at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-93-FAITH. So we're not doing that just yet, although you can go ahead and put the number in your phone and get ready to call us. So leading off, and I'm going to just assume that my producers in my ear are going to let me know when Peter is on and available so he and I can talk together. But I'm just going to lead off then with just the ongoing astounding news out of Thailand. We know more and more about the boys and the coach and the rescuers and the rescue. And we continue to learn more and more. And I didn't know if maybe this news had gotten past you, but there was one young man in the cave whose name is Abdul Sam'an, and he's 14 years old. And he served as the translator for the British divers, who were the ones who actually were first to find the boys. So you can read this in the New York Times. You can also read versions of it on things like World Magazine. So here's my summary of the story. So when the British divers actually located the group of the 12 boys from the Wild Boars soccer team and their 25-year-old coach, who'd been trapped inside the flooded cave in northern Thailand for 2 weeks at that point, 14-year-old Abdul Sam'an was the only one among the whole group who could speak English. And so he asked initially, what day is it? And then he told them that they really needed something to eat. And then he went on to share with them, you know, basically how it was that the boys had survived that long. And following the rescue efforts, then the stories obviously start to pour out. And so we've learned a lot about the coach. He's been praised for reportedly refusing to share the food that the kids had in order that the kids would have more to eat. And then this Abdul has been praised because he acted as a translator between the divers and the team throughout the ordeal. And it's really unusual, actually, for a young person in Thailand, particularly in northern Thailand, to speak English. Only a third of the population of Thailand speaks any kind of English. So you say to yourself, wow, this is really quite amazing that there was a person in this group who was young and spoke English. Well, actually, he speaks four languages. He's fluent in English, Mandarin, Thai, Burmese, and then a fifth language that's a derivative of Mandarin called Wa. So he actually, I would say, speaks five languages, but apparently it's technically four. And so here are some interesting things about this young man that you might want to know in your conversations with others about this extraordinary story. He's actually been raised by a pastor and his wife as an undocumented stateless immigrant from just over the border, where his parents, it's actually the state of Wa, from which his parents brought him in Myanmar. So he's Burmese or Myanmari by birth, but technically Wa is a legally unrecognized area that borders China. And so his parents actually took Abdul across the border and dropped him off at the age of six at the Maasai Grace Church, and the pastor and his wife have raised this boy since he was, well, since he was 6 years old. He has the gift of languages, obviously, and he has been a student who has really excelled both in academics and athletics. And being a part of this Wild Boar soccer team is important to him. And there's three other boys who are also what are described as stateless, as well as the coach, who was also stateless. He was orphaned at the age of 10 and spent part of his growing up years inside of a Buddhist monastery, and therefore knew how to lead these boys in meditation that kept them calm during those 2 weeks in the dark. I mean, which I frankly can't even imagine. So I think that in terms of the conversations that we can be prepared to have with our neighbors and friends and coworkers and those around us in the culture, obviously the analogy to salvation is fairly easy to make here. We all, like sheep or little children, you know, have gone astray. We've all wandered deep into the darkness and all exits have been cut off. We're genuinely lost. We have no hope of saving ourselves. Help literally had to come from the outside and with the willing sacrifice of another. And certainly the sacrifice unto death was made by one brave Thai diver who didn't have enough oxygen in his tank to come back out after he had resupplied oxygen tanks for the boys during the rescue efforts. All of us need to be found and rescued. And that is the story of redemption. That is the story of Jesus Christ. That is the gospel. And so I would encourage you, I would really encourage you to, you know, just use this in your conversations about this Thai rescue, or this rescue of these Taiwanese children and their coach. All right. Excited to be joined now by Peter Kapsner. He is the host of the morning show here on Faith Radio. Peter, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Good afternoon, Carmen. It's great to hear your synopsis of that story.
Yeah, thank you. So I thought it would be fun if today you and I just talked through some of the headlines, and then maybe after the break at the bottom of the hour, we could take calls from people who are listening and just want to converse with us about the headlines of the day and how to bring the mind of Christ to bear.
Oh, I think that sounds great, Carmen. I love just listening in with the listeners and hearing the questions and engaging in that conversation. So that sounds just perfect.
All right, guys. So now that I've got Peter on board and willing, a willing participant in this Friday festivities here on Connecting Faith, you should go ahead and plug the number into your phone. It's 877-93-FAITH, and prepare to give us a call, either about something that we are talking about or, frankly, about something we're not talking about and you want us to be talking about, because we're happy to do that. So, Peter, how about we talk about former President Jimmy Carter and the comments that he has made recently about, well, his speculation about whether or not Jesus would approve of gay marriage and abortion in some forms. Is this a story that you're familiar with?
Yeah, you know, I saw some of the bits and pieces of that, and President Carter's take on this situation, I think, is pretty consistent with where some parts of our culture have shifted in trying to sort of wrestle down this question that has emerged in our culture these last, I don't know, 8-ish years or so. We really weren't asking these questions 8-10 years ago, but in trying to come to grips with some of the sea change that's taken shape since the Supreme Court approved of gay marriage and considered it the law of the land, we've had to wrestle down these questions, and suddenly we're asking questions of the biblical text, or maybe reframing the teachings of Jesus in ways just to try to come to grips with what has happened.
So I think that's probably exactly what troubles me most about President Carter's comments. And for those of you not familiar with this story, in an interview with the Huffington Post, which I guess is now just called HuffPost, the 39th president, who, you know, everyone recognizes, and he self-identifies as a born-again Christian, he was asked over and over, which, Peter, I also find interesting. I mean, the interviewer was apparently not getting the kind of answer that they wanted. And so actually the question was posed multiple times in multiple ways to the former president. On this question of gay marriage, would Jesus approve of it? At least he was honest that the opinions that he was giving were his opinions. And yet I was troubled that he was so willing to say, hey, I believe that Jesus would do this, would approve of gay marriage, And he did say, that's my own personal belief. But then he went on to say things that just go so far beyond what the biblical record indicates Jesus would have said or done. It's not as if we don't have a record of what Jesus had to say about marriage. And so, you know, I know you do a lot of work with young people at the university, and you talk about issues of identity and sexuality and even marriage. So I'm wondering what kinds of conversations your students would be having about, you know, the willingness of an individual to sort of put words in Jesus's mouth or imagine that Jesus would do something that's actually not consistent with what Jesus said.
Yeah, that, I mean, you nailed it, Carmen. And that's I do teach a sexuality course at the University of Northwestern and have done so the last seven-ish or so years. And this is one of the main topics, obviously, at certain points in class we come up to. And where we start is the actual words of Jesus, not the supposed words of Jesus, not the we're going to read some ideas into what Jesus might have meant. We start with the actual record of the text. And specifically, he makes some pretty substantive and pretty straightforward comments in Matthew 19 when the disciples are coming to him, and it's actually the Pharisees first come to him and ask him this question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And it's this trap, and we don't get into all the minutiae into that today, but it's not an honest question. They're trying to trap Jesus to get him to take a side in this divorce conversation. But Jesus is pretty smart, right? And so he didn't try to fall into their trap. Instead, he chose a different option, and he outlined then for them what is normative for marriage, what is God's intention for marriage. When he took them back, he said, in the beginning, it was male and female, and divorce wasn't necessarily part of the conversation at that point, where God had brought the difference in male and female together, and that difference was needed and necessary so that the two of them could work together to sort of steward and to lead God's creation moving forward in this beautiful covenant of marriage. And when Jesus outlined it from a Genesis 2 standpoint, what he was doing in those moments was he was saying anything that falls outside the boundaries of this original covenant, which is meant to be this beautiful relationship of submissive love one to the other, male and female, anything else outside of that would fall short of that design. And so to try to speculate on what the text is silent about, where Jesus didn't address gay marriage, or Jesus didn't address pornography, or Jesus didn't address, you pick, even premarital sexuality, he actually did. In saying what he said and appealing to Genesis 2 and saying this is the design, then anything else that falls outside of that falls short. So it's unfortunate when we begin to try to read into the text or reshape Jesus according to what are admittedly very different, difficult questions in our culture. We still have to attend to the actual words and not put words that we wish Jesus would have said into his actual mouth.
Oh, Peter, that's so helpful. I really appreciate the way that you framed it. And the word speculate and that idea of speculating on things about which the Bible is silent, it should absolutely be consistent with whatever God has actually said. So, all right, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Peter Capster is here with me for the whole hour. We're going to be taking your questions at 877-93-FAITH. So let us know what you're thinking about as we're thinking together about the headlines of the day. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Welcome back. Joining me this hour is Peter Capsner. You know him from the morning show here on Faith Radio. He's also a professor at the University of Northwestern. And he does lots of other great things. So we should talk about some of those things, I'm sure. Peter, thank you for being with me during this hour. We are taking your phone calls if you're listening and you want to give us a call at 877-93-FAITH. You can either join us on the air and ask your question, or if that sounds a little scary and intimidating, you can give your question to the person who answers the phone. So there you go. You got all kinds of options. So I am curious to know sort of how you have reacted, responded, and maybe even engaged in conversation with others about what we saw and heard on the floor of Congress yesterday at the hearing related to a member of the FBI and text messages and all of that. And then also sort of the very wow, character assassination kind of language that we're hearing in relationship to the nominee for the Supreme Court. Just the sort of odd level of discourse we have entered into here as a nation.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, Carmen. I mean, I don't know how you're responding to it, but I would say it's troubling on some levels. It's deflating on others. You know, when you have leadership in place and you hope that they're going to work together on behalf of what's best for the common good, which has been the historical foundation of leadership in our country. And so to have seen some of the just interrogation of Strzok, this FBI agent, from both sides, and to see the level of discourse evolve the way it did into this name-calling and shouting match and disdain for one another, I didn't know we could go to another level. But here we are. We've sunk to another level in how we're talking with one another back and forth. And, you know, I heard a comment at some point that relationships tend to fail when there gets to be disdain within the relationship. And there's that shift that I think happens in our mind and our spirit, right, where we go from we have disagreements, but we're going to work through it. We're committed to a common goal together. To now we're going to have disdain for one another. And once that disdain happens, the relationships are hardly ever salvageable at that point. And I think, I don't know what your take is on that, but I think we're almost at that level right now. And it gets difficult to look to our leadership to be able to say what's going to pull us out of this situation as a country. And frankly, it's been interesting in the last maybe 2 or 3 weeks on the morning show that a number of guests have come out. They've been church leaders, maybe evangelical leaders. And I haven't prompted them for this, but they've had a really similar message each time. They're saying, you know, if the church doesn't get their act together and be the hope in our culture, there's really an opportunity in the void of leadership now that the church could come with a voice of sanity, a voice of reason, a voice of hope, reconciliation coming back together, because it's so obvious now that our leadership in our country is just not in that space. And I have a hard time believing, outside of a pretty major external event, that they're going to come back together just because, you know, when you hit this disdain level, it's just going to get worse from here.
I heard somebody say once that, like, in a marriage can be redeemed or survive anything except contempt. And once you've reached the point of literally holding that other person, you know, in contempt, you just can't recover from that. So I completely agree. Hey, we got a couple of listeners on the line. So Peter, let's talk to these guys. Let me start with Steve in Eden Prairie. Steve, welcome to Connecting Faith. What would you like to say?
Thank you. Well, I was listening to your discussion about the what President Carter said about the gay marriage, that sort of thing. And Jesus was also fairly clear about removing the log out of our own eye before we go after the splinter in somebody else's eye. And it seems to me that the Bible-believing church has largely been silent on the issue of living together before marriage and the issue of divorce. And so I'm wondering if it just makes us feel good to look at somebody else's issues instead of looking at the holiness that we're called to as Christ's body. And I'd just like to hear you guys' responses to the discussion about that.
Steve, thank you so much for sharing, because you're exactly right. We do not consistently, we have not consistently, as the church in North America, brought a positive witness to marriage in general. And we have not preserved the integrity of the holiness of matrimony, certainly not the holiness of the marriage bed. And so those would be the standards to which the church is called, and therefore every member of it. And so I wholeheartedly agree with you that the standard to which we're called in Scripture is sexual purity in singleness, sexual fidelity, which is also a purity in marriage. So, Peter, do you want to pick up from there and comment on Steve's observation?
Yeah, I think spot on observation, Steve, of what you mentioned there, and I think that's for some of the understandable reasons why, you know, people are troubled with why is the church suddenly having such energy and passion about this conversation when it's historically stayed pretty silent on a number of the other conversations, and we do talk about that in class pretty often when you just study the history of this. The divorce kind of tsunami came and went in the 1970s and 80s, and the church really didn't do much with that, but it sort of stayed under the surface. And then it moved into living together. And I remember when I was in pastoral ministry, pastors just didn't really even know what to do. They didn't want to alienate people that were in the living together situation, but they didn't know how to respond. And there wasn't the same kind of energy to say, hang on, we might need to rethink this. And you can talk about pornography in that. You can talk about a number of issues. And so it is interesting, and Steve is just dead on with the idea, why this one are we then trying to come to terms with when we have all these other layers of the conversation we haven't addressed? And so I would suggest, and I'd be curious your thoughts, Carmen, too, that this is an entirely holistic conversation where we should address everything at once relative to, as you've described, the holiness of matrimony. But if we just pick and choose, and it's a pretty hypocritical situation to pick and choose those that we want to have a fight with versus, you know, maybe we need to look at this entire picture. And some of the reasons why we are where we are in the conversation now is because we've left undealt with many, many, many years of conversation. And at the very least, can we approach this with humility and grace and recognize that there's brokenness across the board? And I think that humility and grace is needed to take the logs out of our own eyes before we'd have conversations with anybody else.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith and for your very astute observation. And Peter, thank you for engaging on that. All right, we also have Guy on the line. Guy is from North Dakota. Guy, welcome to Connecting Faith. What would you like to what subject matter would you like to discuss?
I'd like to talk a little bit about the current issues in the news about, free trade versus trade protection and tariffs, and place it in the context of the verses 5 and 6, chapter 4 of Luke. Last week, Bill Arnold had a guest on. They talked about Satan, about his schemes in the world. And, of course, verses 5 and 6 of Luke 4 talk about Satan taking Jesus up to a mountaintop, showing him all the kingdoms of the world, tempting Jesus, saying he could have all these kingdoms, their power and their glory, if he would worship Satan. And, of course, Jesus refused. But therein lies the fact that there is a tremendous amount of control in the world exerted by Satan himself because of the fall of man in the garden. And I think free trade should be framed within that context, because this whole notion of quote-unquote free trade really became part of our national narrative back in the late 90s. And at the same time, when the term globalization started coming into our national narrative. And if you, so that's about 20 years now we've had this quote-unquote free trade with these large multinational agreements that cede authority and power from our nation essentially to the WTO. But anyway, the effect over 20 years has been to really empower and enrich the communist regime that controls communist China. Godless communism.
Okay, hey, I'm gonna guy. I'm gonna have to cut you off because we actually have to go to a break. Peter and I will discuss this after the break. Guy, thank you so much for lifting up this question. Peter Kapsner is with me here today on Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Happy Friday. You know, I'm even one of those people that's, I feel good about saying, you know, happy Friday the 13th, because I'm not superstitious and I don't buy into any of the even black cat superstitions. And so joining me today, because he's my friend and he's a friend of Jesus too, is Peter Kapsner. You know him from the morning show here on Faith Radio. You also know him as a university professor and a wonderful social commentator about the things that are happening in the culture today. So, Peter, thank you for joining me today for these conversations.
It's a pleasure, Carmen. Love it.
So before we went to the break, we had a caller from North Dakota, and Guy is, you know, raising concerns about what I suspect he was eventually going to get to, was the question of, you know, are we headed toward a one world government? Are we headed toward, you know, is now the time we should be, you know, really concerned about Satan taking over the kingdoms of this world? What are the conversations related to fair trade and globalization and the schemes of Satan? So, Peter, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, you know, some of this is obviously going to be well above my pay grade, but I certainly enjoy when we have a
conversation. Since we're not paying you.
Show and-
Yeah, exactly. Well, then I can give you whatever I'd like, Cameron. And by the way, you were off the hook this morning on the morning show related to superstitions and Friday the 13th. Your research, I mean, I'm still sort of simmering in how great that was. So
nice.
Just so you know, it was wonderful stuff. But related to this economic conversation, you know, we will have people on from time to time. And some of them are for more a trade protectionist kind of standpoint, believing that the tariffs really would help our economy. And other people would suggest we need to knock them down and move back towards globalization, as Guy was pointing out. And, you know, history is mixed. History shows that there has been a real favorable economic developments because of tariffs. And history has shown that there's been favorable economic developments when there haven't been tariffs and globalization. But to your point that you addressed, and I think maybe agree where Guy was headed, is that we're sort of always on the lookout for when there's going to be this common empire emerging that may be sort of the seedbed for the rise of the Antichrist. I know there's some schools of interpretation of biblical thought that is saying, well, if these events happen, it's going to allow and pave the way for the Antichrist to come. And that, and a lot of that is when there's this globalized common economic trade that then is housed in one organization. Here's what I can say, Carmen. I don't know about all of that. What I do know is when you look through history, there isn't a generation that has ever existed that doesn't think or at least suspect that maybe they're very close to the end. You can see throughout all generations that there's talk and conversations and looking for the signs that this must be it. This is pretending the end of the world coming up. And so we're not unique in that sense. I think it's important to be well-versed in what's happening around the globe. But to suspect, Jesus himself didn't even know the time and the day. And so to think that we're just that much closer, we may be missing the mark of what the important point is that regardless of what comes, one day there will be the full restoration of all things. All tears will be wiped away. I agree with Guy that we're living in a world right now that is controlled by the spirits of darkness and Satan himself. The text is clear about that. But we're to live a different way in that world, and our hope and our call and our ministry doesn't change regardless of the shape of what's going on in the world.
I appreciate that. So Sharon sent me an email at carmen@myfaithradio.com, and she would like to add to the conversation that we were having with Guy. She would like for Guy to check out and for us to consider what's going on at the Telecom Mobile Technology Congress in China. She says that you should look at all of the biometric chips and AI and facial and car license recognition and behavior data surveillance and the creation of human-like robots and driverless cars and developing a beast system. See, now there you go. See, this definitely feels like it's headed down the direction of, you know, predictive, like as if we could predict. And I am right. One of those people who, you know, I'm going to say right along with Jesus, I don't know. I don't know when the end is coming. I don't know what that's exactly going to look like. Here's what I do know. I'm going to live today as a redeemed believer in Jesus Christ, as a deployed ambassador of the kingdom of heaven. I am going to press forward always and in all ways for the gospel, that more and more people would come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ in order that whenever he returns, he will recognize them as his followers, us as his followers, and we will recognize him as Lord. There's no question that the point in time is going to come when every knee will bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Today's not yet that day. And so my sense of calling is let's get more and more people with their knees bowed now and not wait one more day because we do know that the schemes of Satan are real, and we are in a spiritual battle for eternal souls.
I think that's so beautifully said, Carmen, and that is a call no matter what's happening. And again, I remember back, I'm old enough to remember the Y2K scare, right, where the computers were all going to flip from 1999 to the year 2000, and we all sort of thought planes were going to fall out of the sky, and that would be maybe the first of the bowls of wrath being poured out or the horsemen running. And we thought that could be the case and say that. And it is important. I mean, obviously the world is going to end sometime. And the only clue Jesus really gave us was in saying that there's always going to be wars and rumors of wars and sickness and pestilence and disease and all of that. He said, that's part of the deal in this world that isn't in the shape that it's meant to be. he did say that when those things go on the increase, when they start spinning almost out of control, that those are the beginnings of birth pangs. But again, that's really hard to interpret. When do we know that things are so out of control that it's the beginning of the birth pangs that bring the end? I don't know, and I would rather spend, I guess, as you said, more of my energy being deployed as an ambassador of Jesus, regardless of whether we're 1 year from the end or 1,000 years from the end. Our call to shine light in this world hasn't shifted. I think it's an interesting conversation. I certainly enjoy it, but boy, it can really distract me from the central call.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, friends. Hey, if this is you want to engage with Peter Kapsner and me, Carmen LaBerge, here on Connecting Faith today, maybe there is something going on in the headline news that you would like to discuss. You're saying to yourself, I would really like some help getting God back into this particular conversation. Maybe that's going on in your own home. Maybe it's a conversation that's going on in the community where you live. I know that I mentioned a couple of days ago that I was interested to hear from people in the Twin Cities area in response to the article that was posted in the Star Tribune about churches closing. So if you're, you know, if you're a person who's familiar either with that story in the paper or with that reality in your community, I would love to talk with you. And so the number here in the studio is 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH, or you can always email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. And hey, we have a cool, Peter and I know something that every listeners don't yet know, and that is that we are right on the verge of being able to take your comments or questions via text message at that same number. I don't know if you tried that today.
Yeah,
I don't think that would work today, but that's cool and that's on the horizon. And we're trying to find more and more ways to be in conversation with you, the listener, and because we really don't want this to just be one way. We really do want this to be a dialogue where you, the listener, and we, the people who happen to stand at the microphones, have the opportunity to engage with one another. Hey, Peter, let's talk about the World Cup.
Great. I would love to. I know that's top of the mind always for me with in the morning show. We love bringing it in anytime we can.
All right. So because I don't follow soccer, what's going on at the World Cup? Who's in the finals? When's that happening?
Yeah, well, it's going to be Sunday morning. It's France and Croatia have made it through. I have to admit, being a person who studied in the UK at certain times of my life, I was a little gutted to see England fall. They kind of did what England does, and that's they had good opportunities and couldn't get through. So it's give credit to Croatia. They made it through extra time, I think, in three straight matches. So they were just dead tired at the end, but found a way to come through. And so it's France and Croatia. It's Sunday morning. I believe it's 10 o'clock local time here in Central Time. And I have a bit of a moral dilemma, Carmen, in the sense that I'm supposed to be preaching a sermon at 10 o'clock that morning. And so, you know, it's going to be pretty tough to stay dialed in and maybe away from the text updates and what's going on in the score. I hope nobody texts me in those moments because I want to just get home and watch what happened on tape delay.
Okay, friends. So in a conversation about the World Cup, what we in America call soccer, the rest of the world calls football. And it's a really big deal. And in some parts of the world, it defines community. It defines opportunity. And so, Peter, I actually had the opportunity here earlier to talk on Connecting Faith with an Egyptian Christian. He now lives here in the United States. His name is Mina Abdelmalek. And he's talking about the prohibition against Christians, which in Egypt we're talking about Coptic Christians. So they're known as the Copts.
Yeah.
The prohibition against their playing professional soccer. So anything that you want to bring to that conversation in terms of religious liberty and the opportunity that people are prevented from having?
Well, I think it just highlights again, right, Carmen, that and it's such a cliche, but it's actually one of those cliches that's true, is how much for granted I take our religious freedom. I don't think about being persecuted. I mean, yes, we might get weird looks, and people might not think very highly of Christians in our culture, in certain segments of our culture these days. But I think that the persecution that is going on worldwide is of a kind that I simply just don't appreciate as much as maybe I should. I can't imagine being barred from playing soccer because of my faith. That's a silly thing. You know, you're not being killed at gunpoint in those moments. But we also know, if we remember the headlines from ISIS a few years ago, how terribly these Coptic Christians are being treated in places like Egypt. And it's not going to get better anytime soon. This is just sort of part of the fabric of their life. And that also has been, quite frankly, the pattern of Christians throughout history. In these 2,000 years since the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, Christians have primarily been persecuted, and Christians primarily have not found themselves in social power. So we live in a really unusual and odd time in the United States where Christians have had time and opportunity to practice their faith and freedom. That simply isn't the case very often throughout history, and we see it again in just this simple conversation of some Coptic Christians that can't play soccer in their own country.
Yeah, I think that we probably have never sort of considered it an issue of religious freedom about whether or not we could play soccer in America. It probably never occurred to anybody.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if that's something, friends, that you're concerned about or that's now piqued your interest, you could go to myfaithradio.com. We had that conversation on Tuesday, July the 10th with Mina Abdelmalek. The website is letcops, C-O-P-T-S, letcops play. All right. So we have a caller online from Roseville. I have to scroll back up here. Lynn from Roseville, welcome to Connecting Faith. What would you like to contribute to the conversation?
I just wanted to make a comment that we should always be well aware of our times, that we should, you know, go on pulling people in to know Jesus, but we are commanded to know.
Be students of the time in which we live, like pay attention to the signs of the times and be aware and alert and awake. Is that what you're pointing to, Lynn?
Exactly, but not get out, you know, not just make that the only thing. I just wanted, you know, to make the comment that we should be well aware of our times.
Yeah, like vigilant. I mean, even, you know, vigilant. Yeah, I mean, I wholeheartedly agree. Thank you for adding that to the conversation. Really important point. So, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us and joining the conversation here on Connecting Faith. So, Peter, as you sort of read the signs of our times, what's going on in the culture that you say, hey, this is something that Christians need to be alert to that maybe is kind of under most people's radar?
Yeah, I think that the subtleties, Carmen, that I'm starting to come to wake to a little bit more is just how we sort of acquiesce or just sort of almost yield to whatever's going on in the culture without a lot of thought about it. And I use technology as that example is, When the phones first started coming out, the smartphones, and specifically the iPhone was the first to market on some new levels, I mean, we all lined up and had this cultural phenomenon in Apple stores. You know, people, just seas of people couldn't wait to get it. And I don't think we really thought through what kind of shift that was going to entail in our culture and the kind of impact of it and the rise of anxiety and all of those kinds of ideas. So Lynn's comment about being a student of the times, what I would suggest is you need to step back a little bit and think about what we're thinking about and not just say, hey, just because it's possible or available, just because the internet is there, just because I have a phone, that doesn't mean that these are good things or even neutral things. A lot of times they're pretty destructive. And if we aren't a student of what's happening and thinking critically about what's happening, we just get swept away by the voices of our culture or the opportunities of our culture. We're not really thinking through. And for me, Carmen, that can really dull the senses really quickly. And pretty soon, I'm just kind of going through my day like a sheep beholden to the culture. And that's not the call at all. We're called to really critically think and wonder about, so what is the impact if I'm going to get on this phone all day? What is the impact if I'm going to tweet this stuff on social media? What is the impact if I'm going to kind of mindlessly surf the internet? All of these questions, I think that's one of the biggest dangers is we've sort of yielded our thinking and our capacity to wonder about this stuff, and we just get swept along.
So I'll share this, and then we got to jump to one more quick break. But when you bring up the subject of Apple, immediately what comes to my mind is being with a special needs child walking through a mall, and when we went past the Apple store, it was packed. There's people lined up everywhere, and there's guards, and he looked at the Apple. Right, because there's nothing that says anything. It's actually something that he could read because it's an image, so he could read it. Right, and he looked at the apple and he said, "Is that the apple after Eve took the bite, but before Adam did?"
Wow.
And so,
wow.
I look at the image of the apple now. It's got one bite out of it, and I'm like, "Huh, Well, so anyway, I don't really know if I could theologically make that stick, but it certainly stuck in my mind, you know, as a person with a little person who was making observations about the world that were completely unfiltered. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Peter Kapsner is here with me. We're still taking your calls at 877-93-FAITH, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Joining me today is Peter Kapsner. We've got a few more minutes to take your calls. If you want to join us in conversation here today, the number is 877-93-FAITH, but you got to get to the phone pretty quick. All right, Peter, here's a story that I didn't even send you. So you'll just have to listen along with the audience and then prepare yourself to make comments. So were you aware that a 400-year-old Bible was discovered in a cupboard of an Anglican church in New Zealand?
No, this is okay. Great. So, did they find the One Ring of Power at the same time? This is
just
great.
So cool, right? So this is really quite an extraordinary story. It's also evidence that people don't clean out their stuff very often. And so what might be hiding?
They never be,
yeah, right.
Like, said to me, Carmen, that they could find something 400 years old in my house. Wow.
So, so let me give people the brief in on this. A 1616 edition of the Bible, which, by the way, there were only 30 Bibles printed in 1616. So this is one of 30 Bibles from that particular year. Was discovered. Now, here's what's really extraordinary. It was discovered in 2012. And they didn't tell anybody until now. And the only reason that they even told anybody is because somebody at another church wanted to, you know, show some old Bibles to their congregation in celebration of National Bible Day, which, by the way, New Zealand has a National Bible Day, and it's this Sunday. So all of these were interesting little factoids for me as I read this story. It sat locked in a cupboard, wrapped in a tea towel, from, they think, 1912 to 2012. Now, here's what one person in the article says. Because the church was apparently fairly new, quote unquote, in 1912, right? So in the early 1900s, this church was constructed. And this person said, well, I'm not sure what place an old Bible would have had in a new church at that time. So that's the sentence that I want to use as a jumping off point for conversation. What place does an old Bible have in a new church?
Well, that, I mean, I'm guessing, first of all, it won the old Bible contest in that situation in the church. But, what I love about that is I think, you know, these days I can only remember what happened maybe 5 minutes ago. You know, my attention span has devolved as well in that situation. And I think what I love about this is my faith really begins to grow in vibrancy when I think about all of the people who have followed Jesus before me and that we're really caught up with this great cloud of witnesses, as Hebrews talks about, that we're to continue to run the race. And so to have a Bible from how many ever hundreds of years ago, 400 years ago now, you think about those people that had a hand in constructing this Bible, and they had a hand in this beautiful story that it wasn't the story of the United States. The United States didn't even exist then. Who knows if it was even called New Zealand at that point, but there was at that moment still the kingdom of Jesus, and there were people that were following in those moments and had a chance to, in 1612, that Bible, one of 30, would have been, I'm sure, absolutely sacred. And this almost this pearl that they found, you know, this incredible treasure that they had, because people even, you know, not too long before 1612, Carmen, they didn't even have any access to the Bible at all. The printing press hadn't come through. And so they were dependent upon a few church leaders to try to help them understand what the Bible might be saying. So I just love the history of all of it. And I specifically love that I'm connected to brothers and sisters 400 years ago that have said yes to following Jesus in a time in the world when I'm sure all the lines on the map were quite different than what they are today.
Yeah, I was also thinking that, you know, the Word of God never goes forth, but that it accomplishes that for which he sent it. And when whoever it was packed that Bible up in England and put it on a ship that eventually arrived in New Zealand and carried it wherever they carried it, and then entrusted it to the church, right? Probably at their death. in 1912. And with the hope that the word of God would continue to be declared in ways that would be transformative. The only reason you would hold on to something as sacred is if indeed it was sacred to you. And so maybe it will bring the kind of renewal that the rediscovery of the law brought in the days of Josiah. I mean, that's what I was thinking when I read the story. I'm like, so, you know, I'm thinking to myself, isn't there a story in the Old Testament where, you know, they were like cleaning out a storeroom in the temple and they rediscovered the word of God? They rediscovered the, I feel like it was like a repair story. Like they were, you know, they were repairing something and they rediscovered the law. And then when Josiah read it, he was convicted and converted. He then read it publicly to the people, and they were literally, I mean, the nation was transformed. It was this incredible covenant renewal for the people of Israel. I am now holding out that kind of hope that the word of God would be opened in a new way in New Zealand, and God would strike up a revival that begins there.
Carmen, and you referenced the story here locally in the Star Tribune of Minneapolis that about the churches that are failing and falling apart. And it's so interesting because I did see some statistics that the churches that are not failing are those churches that have remained committed to the Word of God, that they are not just giving sermons on Sundays out of sort of popular culture or top-of-the-mind stuff or kind of opinions of the pastors, which can happen, that they have stayed anchored to the biblical text. I think there's something there that's worth paying attention to, Carmen, and what you mentioned is that all we know that the vibrancy and maturity and depth that is happening in some of the churches tends to be those, and this was just, it was a study done, it tends to be those that have stayed committed to God's word.
So, Peter, the research department of the Connecting Faith Program informs me that New Zealand got its name in 1645, 373 years ago. So, in fact, at the point in time when this Bible was printed in 1616, New Zealand was not yet a country.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah, at least it didn't have a name. I know, phenomenal research department, right? Incredible.
It really is.
It's incredible.
You know, I would like to thank Carmen because I'm a big story guy, so I'd like to think it actually was known as Middle Earth back then. I know that the films of Lord of the Rings were all there. I'm pretty sure that was Frodo, Gandalf, all they were walking around during that time. That explains it.
That totally explains it. Okay, here's my walk-off story for the hour. And again, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. Joining me today is Peter Kapsner from The Morning Show. We love being with you here on Faith Radio. We thank you for joining us in advance. So here's a story out of a church in Texas. I wanted to use it as this week's walk-off as an encouragement to people. Robert Morris is the pastor of a six-campus megachurch called Gateway. He's 56 years old, and in April, he and his wife and their children were at what I will describe as a remote property in the Texas Hill Country. And Robert Morris collapsed. When paramedics arrived, he had no blood pressure and a very weak heartbeat, and they basically turned to his wife and said, "You should get in the helicopter with us and say goodbye." And so as they were life-flighting him, they determined that he was bleeding internally, and he very nearly died during the helicopter life flight. I will let you guys go online and read the whole story. But he had lost half of his blood by the time doctors found and repaired a cantaloupe-sized hematoma. Now, by God's grace and the generosity of people who had been donating blood over time, Robert Morris is alive today. Obviously, they had to replace more than 50% of his blood. So he returned to the pulpit 6 weeks ago, and he told his congregation in detail about his experience, and that is all now available online. And he emphasized that spiritual warfare is real, God answers prayer, God is in control, and then he added this, quote, "Someone giving blood is what saved my life." And we all know that Jesus gave his blood to save all our lives as well. That began a blood donation campaign that today has resulted in the donating of enough blood to save 4,600 lives because the people of Gateway Church are taking seriously giving blood in the name of the one who gave his blood for us. So that's what I got for you today. Have a great weekend and God bless. This has been Connecting Faith, and I'm Carmen LaBurge. Peter Kapsner, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.